today.
He will be rescheduled at some point in the next semester or following, depending on what his schedule allows. So we're back on schedule. I am originally on the schedule for today, and I'm here. Just to give you a bit of an overview of what this series is. It is a somewhat informal gathering in which various people with a stake in writing on campus come and tell you what sorts of tips, what sorts of things can make you a better writer. And I entitled my talk today, presumptuously, how to make your writer love your reader love you, which for all sorts of reasons I almost didn't use that title because it just seemed so presumptuous. But I thought, well, I can approach it from the opposite direction quite comfortably. Namely, how to make your reader hate you. And this is something that y'all have a stake in, right? You don't want your reader to hate you. You want your reader to care about what you're saying. You want your reader to keep reading, and preferably to give you the highest possible grade. Yes? Yes. So it's not really in your interest to make your reader hate you. The problem is, as Dr. Roper has said on more than one occasion, students run the risk of thinking that you as a professor are not a human being, you're a grading machine. And not only that, you're an omniscient grading machine, which can read your mind, and which the professors will read your mind, and they're expecting something that's rather hidden, and if they get it, they'll give you a high grade. In fact, professors are readers like every other reader, and we want to be interested in what we're reading. And grading is not always a process of fun, exciting prose. It's not an experience of sometimes of being all that excited. But every once in a while, you do get a paper that you love to read. And so my purpose here today is to try to make you into a writer of one such paper. I'd like you to read the first paragraph on the handout. And just to tell me, as I'm reading, on a scale of 1 to 10, I want you to think about whether you love reading this paragraph and you want to keep reading the 7 following pages, or if you are inclined not to love this paper. Okay, here we are. The issue of the situation pervasive to the universal human condition seen in the simile that comes before Priam's speech to Achilles in Book 24 is the culmination of the Iliad, the epic poem written by Homer. As when dense disaster closes on one who has murdered a man in his own land and he comes to the country of others, to a man of substance, and wonder seizes on those who behold him, so Achilles wondered as he looked on Priam, a godlike man. This shows the position of Achilles strangely. Manslaughtering is how Achilles' hands had just been described. Priam's arrival at Achilles' tent likens him to the murderer. Homer's implication that Achilles is the man of substance is the opposite of Priam being likened to the murderer. The reader is confused by Homer's inversion, and godlike also confuses the comparison. But discovering of compassion requiring the identification with another and with sin and vulnerability is what is discovered when seen in the context of the poem's action. Okay. Do we have a number 10, where 10 means I love this, give me more of it? 9? 8? 7? 6? Oh, we have a 6 over here. That's Dr. Spring. Huh. Students of his. Take note. A generous reader. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Any zeros? You're here. So, I would say most are about 5 and under. And first thing we want to do is figure out what's wrong here. Why is love not the first thing we're feeling? No palpitating hearts here. Let's look at this first sentence. The issue of the situation pervasive to the universal human condition, seen in the simile that comes before Priam's speech to Achilles in book 24, is the culmination of the Iliad, the epic poem written by Homer. Now, what's wrong with that?
You don't have time to breathe.
Well, it's true, it's very densely packed. What's the action going on in that sentence? What's the main verb? Let's separate the action from the main verb. Let's find the main verb of the sentence. What is the main verb?
Is.
Can y'all find that? Is. And what's the subject of that verb? Issue is. Okay, we've got a problem. You go to a movie. Is the action you want to see is. Now, maybe if you're in philosophy, the idea of being is something that is exciting and riveting. But if you are, even if you are also a philosopher, you're interested, if you're reading about human things, human action. And thought is a form of action. Now, is there, we're not sure what the action is here. Let's just say it's not about an action. Let's just say it's about a concept whose action is just to be. What is the idea that is existing here in this sense? What's the issue? Anybody? And by the way, this is a slightly modified here from what I really do get when I'm grading. The issue of the situation pervasive to the human condition. This is familiar to all of you who grade. What does that mean? What do you think is at the heart of that? Anybody? Yes.
If there's anything in the heart of it at all.
Well, that's a fair question. Of course, as a reader, you want to be generous. Something's here. Is there here, Mr. Spring?
I'd say maybe the pervasive, sometimes it may be perverse. Seems like it must be central to the...
Perverse or pervasive? Those are different...
I guess I would say
huh. Well, the thing is, what we have here is a topic rather than a point. And this is something that, do you know the difference between a topic and a point? A topic is what you're writing about. This student wants to write about the universal human condition. The point is what you say about that topic, right? So there's something going on about being human, or what it is to be human. And it could be very interesting. And I'm guessing that this student has very interesting ideas, because the student is able to use all these abstractions and is trying to ennoble and elevate the prose here. You know, this is not text speak. This is trying to be a paper here. And the problem is, it's a topic, it's not really saying anything yet. Well, what is, and it's also a little bit redundant, the issue of the situation, that's possible, but it's empty so far. It's empty, it's a placeholder. And often when you use very general things in your words, in
it's that they're placeholders for something, and it, what else is general? What else is a sign in the sentence that the sentence is very general, floating around?
Another general thing is that he just says the culmination of the Iliad, the epic poem written by Homer.
It's very general.
Thank you. Yes. The Iliad is an epic poem written by Homer. That suggests takeout containers, styrofoam, filler. Your audience knows that Homer wrote the Iliad, I think. And in general. Now, there's something interesting going on, and we just have to get past the first sentence to find it. Promising, there's a topic, but we need to dig down and get more general. So let's go to the next sentence. As when dense disaster closes on one who has murdered a man in his own land, and he comes to the country of others to a man of substance, and wonder seizes on those who behold him, so Achilles wondered as he looked on Priam, a godlike man. Okay, any problem there?
So yes. Is it really an introduction to the quote?
It's a quote, which is good. We like quotes, grounded in the text. But it's floating in deep space. That's a problem. And this happens often. Your reader is chugging along, wanting to know how to read a quote, how you are reading the Iliad, and suddenly, out of the blue, like a Steinway falling out of a fifth-story window, comes a quotation, and it crashes to the ground, and you're not sure what to make of it. So, not a bad thing to have a quote. In fact, this paragraph is about that simile. It's actually a good thing here to quote it. But we don't have much of an introduction. Huh. Next sentence. This shows the position of Achilles strangely. Now that's actually a pretty easy sentence to understand, right? It's not too long, not too abstract, has an interesting word in it. Two of them, show, strange, right? We're out of the zone of is. We now have verbs. We have showing, and we have strange showing, which that sounds really interesting. What's the problem with this sentence? Also, by the way, for those of you grading papers or who will go on to grade papers, you're going to find sentences like this all the time, and you're going to circle a word. What word are you going to circle?
This.
Yes. Why did you say that?
Because you don't know what this is.
Exactly. This is has an ambiguous antecedent, which is a very highfalutin way of saying this. What shows the position of Achilles strangely? Is the dense disaster showing the position of Achilles strangely? Is the country of others showing? Is it the whole thing that's showing? Is it part of it that's showing? What part of it? What are you looking back at? And if you're in spoken speech, there are all sorts of verbal cues you can make, like pointing, you know, this. But when you're writing, this is very ambiguous. And I would say avoid using this as a pronoun. Whenever you say using this as a pronoun, ask yourself, this what? You know, if it said, this simile shows the position of Achilles strangely, that would be better, right? If it said, this likening of Achilles to X shows us something unexpected, I mean, that would be even more specific, right? Okay, let's keep going. Manslaughtering is how Achilles' hands had just been described. Priam's arrival at Achilles' tent likens him to the murderer. Homer's implication that Achilles is a man of substance is the opposite of Priam being likened to the murderer. Okay, I read those sentences together. describe how you feel when I'm reading those three sentences in order.
The sentence structure is very similar in each one, and it's boring to read.
They are sort of similar, you mean in terms of that they're about the same length, and they have a subject which is close to a verb, and so there's something that repeats. Was that your sense that it's so are you happy with that repetition, or is there something not clear about the repetition?
I guess I just feel like something's missing.
There's no transitions between each sentence. They're all kind of disjointed, and you're not leading your reader through your thoughts.
That they don't seem to quite follow from one another. Now, what is it that makes them, what's happening here that is causing them to give you a little bit of reader's whiplash? There are many ways of approaching links between sentences, and I'm not going to be able to cover all of them. There was a hand up there.
I was just going to say that's almost like they made a format before writing it, like bullet points, and then instead of like making it flow, they just laid it all out. They didn't like do any transition.
That's right, and so the transition there. Now, is there any way of making the transitions here any clearer? Manslaughtering is how Achilles' hands had just been described. Priam's arrival at Achilles' tent likens him to the murderer. Homer's implication that Achilles is a man of substance is the opposite of Priam being likened to a murderer. They seem all connected. What's the thing that is causing our attention? We could say and. We could say these are all different ways of saying what's unexpected about the simile. Who's the agent, the character, the actor of each of these sentences in sequence? First one is what?
Manslaughtering.
Okay, so we have a concept as our agent. The second one, Priam's arrival. The third, Homer's implication. And then after that is the reader. If the subject, if the cast of characters that you are using in a paragraph keeps switching. You're looking over here, then I'm looking here, then I'm looking here, then I'm looking here. I'm looking at all these different characters. It's confusing for me as a reader. It's confusing for you as a reader. You want to decide on who your characters are in your paragraph when possible, and try to stick with them. Or at the very least, use parallel constructions so that it's clear when you're switching from one to the other. Here we have people interspersed with concepts, and we're switching our focus with every sentence. And that's disorienting, very disorienting for your reader. But as your name is?
Jason.
Jason pointed out well. It has that quality of this sequence of sentences has a quality of being taken directly from notes, you know, jotted down, and then stuck into the paragraph. When in fact, so now the task of the writer is to make it smoother, focus on a particular character or a particular actor. Even if it's a concept, it doesn't even have to be a character. It could be the writer, it could be the reader, it could be the poet. But try to decide who your characters are, what the main action is, and keep that point of view as best you can. Let's go back to Homer's implication that Achilles is a man of substance is the opposite of Priam being likened to the murderer. What's about this? Homer's implication that Achilles is a man of substance. Okay, that sort of works when you think about it. Homer's implying that Achilles is a man of substance, right? So we're saying Homer's implication that Achilles is the man of substance is the opposite of Priam being likened to the murderer. What's it saying? But when you explain that, you used parallel constructions. You said, this man is a man of substance, just as this one is a murderer. Now, part of the thing that makes you as a reader get tense when reading this particular sentence is that there seems to be a parallel idea that is not being described using a parallel grammatical structure. Homer's implication is not parallel to Priam being likened. I mean, the parallel construction would be Homer's implication that Achilles is a man of substance is opposed to his implication that Priam is the murderer. And then your name is?
Jason Jerry.
Jerry said, once you put it that way, then opposite doesn't quite work there. That you don't notice that the opposite doesn't quite work when the terms are not parallel, because you're too busy trying to figure out what it means. So next. The reader is confused by Homer's inversion, and godlike also confuses the comparison. Again, do you see an issue with parallel construction? Yes, Jerry.
I think the problem with both this sentence and the last sentence, for the most part, is the diction, the choice of words, right? The first one you choose is opposite, I guess, to sound more intelligent, but basically the sentence is very basic, you know. And then the second one, all he would have had to include would have been the word godlike instead of and godlike, because we have to kind of revert back to the quote and by godlike, you know.
Oh, so the reader is confused by Homer's inversion, and the word godlike also confuses the comparison. Yeah, that's definitely helping the reader out. And using that word is adding something which is there, obvious in the mind of the writer, but not obvious in the mind of the reader. One other thing, the opposite. We're still not sure what opposite means here, but it seems to be, I guess, some sort of, it seems to echo this idea of inversion, and I'm wondering if that that sentence, the reader is confused by Homer's inversion, is implying that what came before has already been described as an inversion. Does that make sense? The Homer's inversion kind of dropped out of the blue, and is it clear to you what the inversion is? But discovering of compassion requiring the identification with another and with sin and vulnerability is what is discovered when seen in the context of the poem's action. Okay, this last sentence looks a lot like the first sentence, right? Because there's the is as the main verb. And the other thing is, where's the subject of is? What's the subject of that verb? The single?
Discovering.
Discovering, right? Okay. And notice, this is another little detail that's confusing for you as a reader. In this sentence and in the first sentence, notice how far apart discovering is from is. And notice how far apart issue is from is. Right? Is that the reader is very happy when there is a verb, an action that is vividly depicted, and B, the subject of that action is close to the verb. If you have a lot of subordinate verbiage between your subject and your verb, your reader can get very confused. Your reader forgets who the subject was of the verb. Also, what's the most important part of this last sentence? What do you think is the element of the sentence that the writer was most excited about? But discovering of compassion requiring the identification with another and with sin and vulnerability is what is discovered when seen in the context of the poem's action. Yes, Jared.
The sin and vulnerability seem to be maybe the main points.
Compassion.
Okay.
It kind of makes us think of like the whole point of the entire scene, maybe, would be to comment on the sin and vulnerability that we're experiencing. Yes. That's why I think.
Where is it in the sentence? Where is the most interesting stuff? Would you say it's the first half of the sentence or the last half of the sentence?
I think the most important part is compassion and identification with sin and vulnerability. I'm going to go with the first half.
Yeah, anybody think it's in the last half? Jerry? So you think it's the discovery?
No, I think it's about the sin and vulnerability.
Oh, well, then that is the first part of the sentence. You don't think it is what is discovered when seen in the context of the poem's action.
Okay, first part, sorry.
Now, if we could rephrase this and say, when we look in the context of the poem's action, what we discover is that compassion requires identifying with another and with sin and vulnerability. Would that sound more interesting to you as a sentence? Was there a no? By ending with, when seen in the context of the poem's action, there's a kind of depletion. It's telling us how we get to the discovery. It's not telling us what the discovery is. And your reader is really expecting the most exciting stuff at the end of the sentence. Now, by the way, this does not mean that you have to put all your new information at the very end of your essay. You still want to put the main point of your paper up at the beginning of your paper to give your reader some warning. Because remember what happened when that quotation was dumped in your lap without any introduction. Your reader panicked. The reader thought, why are we even using this quotation? And so too with points. On the other hand, in the structure of a sentence, your reader is expecting that your new information is going to come at the end. And your old information is going to come at the beginning. As we saw in the previous example, this is what happened. And we're going to stress this again. If I say, we're going to stress this again, as we saw in the previous example, that's stressing the example, right? It's not stressing what we found. If I say, my roommate is strange but nice, this seems like it's a good situation. If I say, my roommate is nice but strange, that sounds like I might have a problem. Right? Because the last part is what gets stressed. So let me just put a few things up here. So far, this is the negative. Things that have not gone so well. Number one, find something interesting. Say and tell your reader why it is interesting. That's the first rule here. Now, is there something interesting that this writer so far has glommed onto that you think the writer really might be interested in? What's the neatest part of this paragraph so far? Jerry? Yeah, there's something there that's more specific about compassion, which is going to be good. What else do you think was making the writer interested in talking about this example? I mean, anyone?
It's the difference, the unexpected juxtaposition of Achilles.
Yeah, exactly. The strangeness, right? I like that. There's a strange simile going on. Don't think that you have to, you know, talk about the human condition and the, you know, ponderous profundity of the epic, when in fact, you're looking at something really interesting. You should say, this is neat, this is interesting. Next, two, keep, decide on your sentence's action and put it in a vivid, active verb. Your reader loves verbs, loves action. So when you get a lot of is or seems, that's not as exciting as a vivid verb that is describing something that is interesting. Subsection one. Next, keep subject and verb closer rather than further away apart. And that's just so your reader isn't confused. Next, be precise and avoid this as a pronoun. Next, keep your cast of characters. Running out of ink. Keep your cast of characters. This is not working either. Manageable. And subjects I'll say well subjects of well should I put up this sentence keep your cast of characters manageable and put consistent as subjects. Consistent as subjects. Next, six, use parallel constructions for parallel ideas, right? And seven, put your new information at the end of a sentence. Link this way. Do you all understand when I say what link this way means? I mean, people can talk about logic and different sorts of connections, but think about it. If you say, Homer uses a strange simile, the simile is strange because it involves an inversion. The inversion involves calling a murderer a rich man and a rich man a murderer. The literal murderer is in fact someone who will discover compassion. Compassion is the end of the episode. I mean, I just sort of brought that out of thin air, but do you see how it's linked? Where you the new information of the last part of the sentence can become the new information of the next sentence? Yes? I mean, it works. Your reader likes that. Now you can't always do that. But such linking gives a coherence that avoids that effect that Jason had brought to our attention. Let's look at the next paragraph to see if you like it any better. Just before Homer shows us Priam begging Achilles to give back Hector's body, the poet includes a very strange simile that reverses what we might expect. He likens rich King Priam to a murderer and man-killing Achilles to a rich man who can provide peace. The poet writes, as when dense disaster closes on one who has murdered a man in his own land, and he comes to the country of others, to a man of substance, and wonder seizes on those who behold him, so Achilles wondered as he looked on Priam, a godlike man. In other words, Priam has arrived at Achilles' camp just as a murderer has arrived in the country of others. And Achilles looks at Priam in wonder, just as the rich man's court looks in wonder at the murderer. But the real murderer here, the one with manslaughtering hands, is surely Achilles, while the literal man of substance is surely Priam, king of all the gold in Troy. Why would Homer include a simile that inverts these characters? This inversion is compounded by calling Priam godlike. Why liken a godlike man to a murderer? Yet this simile, which in effect turns each man into the other one, prepares us for what will happen next, an act of pity and compassion that requires a man not only to get outside of himself, but to feel the disorienting pain of guilt and loss that is at the heart of our shared humanity. Now, this second paragraph isn't really saying much more than the first one is saying, right? Informationally. I mean, as far as that, the actual the student reading, thinking about it, writing about it, the same ideas are there. But in terms of a scale of which one of these two would you want to keep reading more of, raise your hand if it's number two. Anybody with number one? What, I mean, any ideas of what it is that makes the second one more effective? I mean, it's found something interesting to say, and it's, how has it shown what's interesting? How? Yes?
All the rules that are up there?
Yeah, I mean, it's very specific, right? It says, here, look, this is a contradiction. It also points to specific elements. It says, look at this one. You might have read this a million times, but let me tell you what I see in it. Right, which is something that the professor really, really wants to hear. We want to be told how you're reading it, what do you see? And we want to be shown specific elements and why they fit or they don't fit. Very specific. There are wonderful, vivid verbs. The use of questions. Don't be afraid to use questions. If you have questions, we want to hear them, especially if you take a stab at answering them. The cast of characters, notice how I use the poet here. I use Homer. You don't always have to do that. You might be writing a paragraph on Helen. You might be writing a paragraph on Achilles. In this case, I wanted to, the paragraph highlights the conscious choice on the part of the poet to use the simile and what the effect of that is, so it's appropriate. Parallel construction, new information at the end. Do you see the effect of having the new information at the very end of that sentence? Suddenly our shared humanity, right? At the very end of the sentence becomes, it's no longer like a wired to the moon abstraction, right? It's no longer the issue of the situation pervasive to the universal human condition. Well, why is it a problem that way at the very beginning, and it's not a problem at the very end? Right? It's still pretty abstract, but what's different in the way that it gets phrased? It's the same student, same thought, same idea, same appeal, but why does it work in the second one and it doesn't work in the first? Yes?
Is it because it's at the heart of the paragraph, not just the society? It's more like a conclusion. It's more like, hey, this is why I talked about this interesting simile. It's because of this.
Yeah. Now, it's not in the heart, because the heart would be in the middle, right? It's at the end. But what it's doing is bringing together everything that's already been discussed. Without that material, without that, it becomes very empty. Just to say the disorienting pain of guilt and loss that is at the heart of our shared humanity. I mean, that is actually more specific than the very first one, which is just the issue of the situation pervasive the human condition. It would have been more effective in this first paragraph if the issue of guilt and loss. The guilt and loss that causes us to realize our shared humanity drives the simile that Homer includes before the scene with Priam. I mean, you could have said that, right, in the first one, and that would have a little more specificity to it. You could understand a little bit more what the point's going to be. Just saying the abstraction of the human condition is empty without the... Also, the parallelism. Not only to get outside himself, but to feel the disorienting pain of loss, right? Those are parallel constructions, and they're building on one another, which is very effective. Often, it's effective to start with a short subject, and then if you want to have a longer and longer predicate and parallel constructions, the reader gets the feeling that the sentence is building towards something, and it makes the reader happy, and it makes the reader love what the reader is reading. I've gone on too long. Do you have any questions? Well, this is a very cursory overview. Yes?
I noticed in here that in the second paragraph, which I think is very well written, that it appears to use passive voice a few times. So I know that we're told not to use passive voice, but what sort of guideline would you give us? Okay, you can use passive voice in this instance.
Keep subject and verb closer. Sometimes you have a subject that's really, 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 really long. The colloquium, which went on and on and on and on, which went on longer than I really had time for because I had to go and do my thing, finally ended, right? It would make more sense to say, thus ended the colloquium that went on too long. And sometimes it involves a passive construction to do that. Also, right here, the passive characters. Sometimes you want to say, you know, Achilles did this, Achilles did this. Achilles was also the one who had this done to him, because you want to keep Achilles as the subject, and in that case, you also sometimes want to use the passive. These rules are helpful. Don't overuse the passive, but if you have to choose between a passive and keeping your subject thread more consistent with the logic of your sentence, use it. The time that you want to avoid the passive construction is if it's a type of deflection where you're using the verb to be and you're just avoiding naming an agent, right? But if you're doing it for a reason, as with breaking all grammatical rules, you can break them all if, and only if, you can give a good reason why it's rhetorically effective, right? So, thank you so much.